This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Your number is 877-217-5757. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services. Short visit to start our show today from Tim Mack, NPR's Washington investigative correspondent, was one of NPR's lead reporters on the Mueller investigation and the first Trump impeachment. And his latest work is Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim reports the NRA is in turmoil, once one of the most influential lobbying organizations in the United States. Recent missteps by the group's top leadership have led to a highly publicized investigation, filing for bankruptcy, and a series of high-profile resignations. What do you think, Tim Mack, as we look at the NRA? Is there a future for this group, or is it dead on arrival?
You know, the NRA is in a serious crisis right now. It's got a revolt among some of its members, angry about misconduct inside the organization. It's got protests from within its own board of directors about misspending. It's got numerous investigations into its conduct. It's got financial problems to the extent that in 2018, it almost couldn't make payroll, which is a very serious problem for any organization. And it's got the New York Attorney General filing in court litigation that says the NRA is so corrupt from top to bottom that it needs to be dissolved. And so, you know, it's really facing the most serious crisis and challenge to its existence that it's ever faced in its over 150-year history.
Well, you note that for years, there was funded, hidden, lavish lifestyles of designer suits, private jets, yachts, five-star hotels, and yet Wayne LaPierre and his wife, Susan, they went merrily on their way. What happened to change all that?
Well, the thing is that Wayne LaPierre and Susan LaPierre, they still occupy these incredible positions of power, the very top of the NRA power structure. They're still there, even though there's been all this documentation of tens of millions of dollars of, like you said, private jet flights, exotic vacations to the Bahamas and to Europe. We're talking lavish meals, six figures in Italian menswear for Wayne LaPierre's use. It's a really interesting story. You know, in order to do this book, I interviewed some 120 people inside the NRA universe and obtained thousands of pages of secret court depositions and internal NRA emails and private documents in order to paint a picture of the personalities that are really living behind the scenes in the NRA.
Why hasn't LaPierre been dumped?
That's an interesting question. You know, in this book, I paint Wayne LaPierre and his personality by talking to so many people who knew him and his wife, Susan. Now, Wayne LaPierre is a deeply, deeply anxious person, and you could even argue a sort of cowardly person, someone who's really anxious of personal conflict and controversy, which is kind of ironic, being the head of, you know, one of the most powerful and controversial organizations in America today. And, you know, the book starts out with this scene in Wayne LaPierre's wedding, where he doesn't really want to get married, and the ceremony just doesn't start. He doesn't show up. And the best man, his best man, puts a $100 bill on the dashboard and says, I don't think you should get married either. We should just drive off and leave. But ultimately, Wayne LaPierre is talked into it, kind of harangued into it by Susan LaPierre and the priest. And he goes through with it in this very awkward ceremony. And why do I tell that story? It shows you a lot about the personality of Wayne LaPierre, who's led the NRA for decades now, and how he's been able to be talked into or harassed or abused and verbally abused in such a way that powerful people in the NRA realize that if you just yell at Wayne LaPierre long enough, he'll eventually approve the millions of dollars that you want for your contracts or your golden parachutes for executives or other things like that that have landed the NRA in such deep trouble.
Tim Mack with us for a few moments. Familiar voice on NPR. You've heard him on All Things Considered and Morning Edition and other programs. And his book is Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. You note that one of the overreaches before the recent scandals and financial quandaries was a spot that ran in which the NRA targeted President Obama's daughters, asking the question, are the president's kids more important than yours? And the first call that came into the NRA office of Mr. LaPierre was from none other than Louisiana U.S. Senator Mary Landrieu. Why was she upset?
You know, for so long, the NRA has valued as its strategic partners, above all else, moderate Democrats. You might think, oh, well, the NRA is kind of an institution of the right. But for so many years, their most strategic value was to be able to bring Democratic lawmakers into the fold and reach out to both sides of the aisle. It's particularly useful to have allies like Senator Landrieu and other Democrats who agree with their opinion. And so when the NRA began to take this turn towards just pursuing kind of conservative culture war approaches to gin up fundraising and membership, people like Senator Landrieu were among the first to object and the first to kind of be dropped out of that coalition. The NRA decided that it was just much less interested in reaching across the aisle after the shootings at Sandy Hook and resulting legislation that came, was proposed after that. It's been a really interesting evolution over the last decade when you look behind the scenes of what happened.
Tim, you write that the NRA's grip on Washington began to loosen in the wake of the massacre at Sandy Hook Elementary. What caused that event, above all others, to be a searing moment for the National Rifle Association?
Well, you might remember that after the terrible shootings at Sandy Hook, the NRA's response was that there should be more guns in schools, that there should be more armed guards in schools. And I think that a large proportion of Americans felt that that was probably not the right tone to take, and that the NRA's response kind of missed the feeling of the time. And that's really one of the pivot points for the NRA. After the shootings at Sandy Hook, the NRA kind of, like I was saying, doubles down on this culture war approach, which is very successful for a short period of time in raising money during the Obama years, but which really begins to fail after Trump is elected.
This book, Misfires, a culmination of a four-year investigation by our guest Tim Mack, and you report that NRA executives made a 2015 trip to Moscow, a by-invitation affair packed with meetings with Russian government officials, diplomats, oligarchs seeking influence in American politics. What precipitated this?
What's so great about this book, I think, is that it's so full of scenes and anecdotes. What happened behind this curtain? The NRA is just such a black box to a lot of people, and certainly was to me when I started this a few years ago. And to see the personalities come to life and understand what these people are really like in real life was super interesting. And so the anecdote that we're talking about involves an individual named Maria Butina, who kind of infiltrated the NRA. She was a Russian citizen who spent a lot of time trying to network with senior NRA officials, and they were just totally kind of beholden to her. She managed to get the NRA to pay for her trips and networking and all sorts of fees that benefited her. And she was ultimately charged with and convicted of being of conspiracy to be an unregistered Russian government agent. She went to prison for that and was ultimately deported. But what this story tells you is just how easily the NRA got played.
Well, Tim, I know you're short on time. Tim's making the rounds. This book is getting exceptional plaudits for good reason. Misfire, a four-year investigation by one of the best reporters in the business. A listener did ask if you have a few seconds whether you report, and I know you do, the feud between LaPierre and Oliver North. That's in the book, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's a very climactic scene where I bring you inside the hotel suite where they have this kind of final confrontation. Oliver North wants to audit the internal finances of the NRA. Wayne LaPierre and other top officials just won't let him do it and push him out of the presidency of the NRA. And I get into the room, tell you what was said, who was there, what the room looked like. And that's one of the real benefits of Misfire, because it takes you into the places where these conversations and these conflicts happened over the last decade that explain why the NRA is in decline today.
Well, thank you, Tim Mack. The book is Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Keep going, and we'll hear you soon, I'm sure, on other NPR programs airing on this station. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure. And today is the fourth day of November, and it was on this date 13 years ago that Barack Obama was elected President of the United States, defeating John McCain. His running mate, of course, was Joe Biden, who last year, on the third day of November, as in a year ago yesterday, defeated Donald John Trump. The final tally in that race, by the way, Biden 81,268,924 votes, Trump 74,216,154, a gap of more than 7 million votes, 51.3 for Biden, 46.9 for Trump. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email, and it's always good to talk politics. And I mentioned the landslide win by Joe Biden a year ago yesterday. Combine that with two narrow wins yesterday or Tuesday in the governor's races in Virginia and in New Jersey. And New Jersey, the Democrat barely held on, Phil Murphy, and in Virginia, the solid favorite, Terry McAuliffe, was defeated in his bid to return to the mansion. And both of those races were hotly contested and much, much, much closer than the presidential election. And thank goodness the candidates who lost the races aren't saying voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud, and spreading lies. 877-217-5757 is your number, and we're joined now by Keith Plessy. He's a descendant of Homer Plessy, one of the most infamous cases in U.S. Supreme Court history, 1896, the landmark decision of the High Court, in which it ruled that racial segregation laws did not violate the U.S. Constitution as long as the facilities for each race were equal in quality, a doctrine that came to be known as separate but equal. That decision legitimized the many state laws reestablishing racial segregation in the American South in the Reconstruction era. It began in 1892 when Homer Plessy, a mixed-race resident of New Orleans, deliberately violated Louisiana's Separate Car Act of 1890, which required equal but separate railroad accommodations for white and non-white passengers. Plessy was charged with boarding a whites-only card. His lawyers defended him at trial, arguing the law was unconstitutional, but Plessy lost, and the conviction was sustained by the Louisiana Supreme Court, and then the U.S. Supreme Court voted 7-1 in a decision against Homer Plessy. So there we go. And today at 3:30, there will be a forum at LSU addressing this, and one of the participants is our guest, Keith Plessy. And good morning to you, Keith.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. When you were growing up, were you indoctrinated with the significance of your forebearer?
Well, it wasn't a conversation that we held at the dinner table. I can say that I found out through one of my elementary school teachers that my name was very close to Homer Plessy's name, and you know, pretty much exactly the way it was spelled. And I was introduced at a very young age to that fact that I was related to Homer Plessy, but I didn't know my direct connection to him.
Well, Homer Plessy, you say he was 1/8 black, correct?
According to his genealogy research that I found out about much later, his great grandmother was a former slave, and that's how they determined the 1/8 black.
That would be,
of course, his
12.5%
was one of them. Yeah, well, of course, his complexion was one of the reasons they selected him to be a plaintiff in the case, and he was an active person in society. He was a member of a group to keep the schools open for black children when they were closing the schools at the end of Reconstruction.
Well, that Supreme Court decision was only 125 years ago. and in the blink of an eye, based on the history of the universe, the world has changed. And for those who believe that we're in bad times now, think of where we were then and how it was for people of color. I would imagine Homer Plessy and your relatives were affected by this immensely.
Well, and even in my time, I can say that there was a park that I couldn't go into on the weekend. It was restricted. And it was one of those rules that was not written, but you know, if you were a black kid, you couldn't go into that park on the weekend. And it was a public park. So it affected me in my time.
Yeah, and to some degree, of course, we have systemic racism in our country today. But thank God, even with a very conservative high court, I don't think a court today would vote as that court did. It would vote probably 9-0 the other way, which says something about how we have evolved in a positive way. But still, attitudes have not been altered in some cases. In fact, I think if we look back to 1991 when David Duke lost to Edwin Edwards, in some cases, the attitudes, if anything, have been hardened over the last generation. How do you explain that?
Over centuries, that you can even stem it back to slavery itself. And there's been so many ways to the exclusion of black people into our society. From the very beginning, slavery was the worst of all. And then you reach a part where you have a bloody civil war to reach a point of your 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments during Reconstruction. And eventually, Plessy v. Ferguson comes along and legal discrimination is developed throughout the nation.
This happened after the Civil War. Yeah, it was 35 years after the start of the Civil War, and still the Supreme Court votes 7-1. Who was the one dissenter, by the way? You know?
That was Justice John Marshall Harland, the great dissenter. There's some people here in the state of Louisiana, the retired judges of America, the division here in Louisiana. I've been in touch with Judge Darrell White, retired Judge Darrell White, and Justice John Marshall Harlan has a serious effect on every Supreme Court justice that enters into the Supreme Court. They have to swear on a Harlan Bible. And Chief Justice at the time, Harlan, was in office, and the story goes that the Harlan Bible was called upon to swear each one of the members to promise that they would never let something that happened in Chattanooga, it was a lynching. And the lynching happened as a result of the Supreme Court awarding a stay of execution to this gentleman in Chattanooga. He was held in jail, and when the stay of execution was announced, he was immediately lynched. So he never made it to court. And Chief Justice at the time, John Marshall Harlan, had all the justices swear on the Harlan Bible that they would never allow that to happen again. And that was in 1909, according to the story of the judge, Judge Darrell White. And we received, I didn't mention that I'm a co-founder and president of the Plessy and Ferguson Foundation, which flips the script on Plessy versus Ferguson. And Judge Darrell White and the retired judges of America awarded the Plessy and Ferguson Foundation an engraved copy of a Harlan Bible. So I'm very proud of that award that we received from the retired judges of America.
The event today is 3:30 p.m. at the Manship School, Separate and Unequal, The Legacy of Plessy versus Ferguson. Keith Plessy is one of the panelists. Keith, we have a few seconds remaining. Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm born and raised here in New Orleans, Louisiana, same city where Homer Plessy was arrested. in 1892. I grew up in the 7th Ward of New Orleans. Of course, I've been all around the city, but the 7th Ward was a special area. We were brought up in a very close-knit society. And to tell you the truth, we had Italian, Chinese, German, Native American people in our neighborhood. So it was a very mixed. And I grew up here in the city, learning our history. Like I said, I learned in elementary school that I was related to Homer Pleasant.
Well, Keith will be on hand today in Baton Rouge, and we thank him for joining us today, and look forward to seeing him today. 3:30 Manship School, Racism, Dismantling the System is the forum that will be on display. Thank you, Keith Plessy. We'll be back with Mark Ballard on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. Talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address. We always look forward to hearing from you in various ways. And usually when Mark Ballard is with us, we get several respondents, and that's good. So again, 877-217-5757. Mark is, of course, reporting about matters near and far, and right now, the political world has been surveying the landscape after two key elections in New Jersey. A Democrat who was expected to win big barely held on as governor, Philip Murphy. He does become the first two-term governor of New Jersey from the Democratic side since the 70s, and it was an extremely close race. And in the great state of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Virginia, Terry McAuliffe took it on the chin, and he lost to a political newcomer who in many ways resembled one Eddie Rasponi, a businessman who had not run for office before. And it shows you what a few thousand votes can mean as far as perception. Rasponi is now remembered as a failed candidate, and he lost by just 40,000 votes. And if you take out New Orleans and Baton Rouge, he won in the rest of the state by over 150,000 votes. But Terry McAuliffe was defeated in his bid to return to the mansion. They don't allow consecutive terms in Virginia. And as a result, the Democratic Party took one that they expected to win, losing a race that was not expected to go to Glenn Youngkin. But Glenn Youngkin won the election. And Mark, in one of his recent columns, as I pull it up right now, on October 31st, as in a few days ago, critical race theory debate back and scarier than ever. And Glenn Youngkin used this issue to his benefit, may have won him the election considering how close it was. And it is an interesting issue that in this case, in a southern state, it took precedent over the usual gods, guns, and gays. What do you think, Mark Ballard?
Well, I think that a couple of things, that Youngkin was able to embrace Donald Trump without actually calling on Donald Trump, which kind of tamped down the fears of Donald Trump in the suburbs around Washington. And that hurt Terry McAuliffe's vote, though he did very well up there. He didn't do as well as he had in the past. And I think that that what we're seeing is that the ability to of the Republicans to kind of mine parental anger over anti-masks for school children and this critical race theory, or how race will be taught in the public schools, is a viable issue, which we're going to see a lot of come 2022.
And this critical race theory, it is being debated robustly in Louisiana. You note that in Lafayette, the Fleur-de-Lis Republican Women, a grassroots partisan club, offered $1,000 in college scholarships to high school senior girls who write winning 800 to 1,000 word essays on how the theory undermines our republic.
Yeah, I think that the issue is basically, how are we going to teach the nation's history of undeniable history of racial discrimination in the public school system. And that seems to be what the argument is. Critical race theory is, I think it's a misappropriated term, but is now been kind of encapsulating all sorts of thoughts along this issue of how we're going to teach racial discrimination in the school systems. And it's a powerful issue.
Well, yesterday, Quinn Hillier said that in Virginia, even though it may not be called critical race theory, that whiteness is bad is being taught. Now, I don't know that what is being taught in Louisiana means it's being discerned as whiteness is bad, but you say that seventh graders already study the Mayflower Compact, the Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Dred Scott decision, other documents, and they're supposed to read the Federalist Papers. And Bessie proposes to add discussions about William C.C. Claiborne, the first American governor of Louisiana, the pirate Jean Lafitte, and Oscar Dunn, the first elected black lieutenant governor of any U.S. state. What would be wrong with that?
Well, that's a good question. What would be wrong with that? I fall among the folks that think that racial discrimination as part of our history needs to be brought up. And it does not necessarily translate into white kids ought to be ashamed of their history. It just is. This is what it is, and we should study it like we study anything else. That does not mean that American exceptionalism is not being taught. I mean, it is being taught, but there is also this portion of our history which needs to be looked at as well.
877-217-5757 for Mark Ballard. Mike in Villa Del Rey. Mike, you're on with Mark.
Good morning. My question, my time spent in Jersey and Fairfax, Virginia, all over Jersey, taxes was always the main issue that my friends voted for Republicans up there. They're not as hard on labor. They're more liberal, and it was taxes, the whole deal. But my question in Virginia to Mark is, do you think that the ties to the Clintons may have hurt this guy running for governor, because people wore out with the Clintons?
All right. What about Terry McAuliffe's ties to William Jefferson Clinton and Hillary Clinton? He was a big supporter. He was chair of the Democratic Party, the national party, at one point. Did that hurt him?
I don't know. I mean, the Clintons are so far back that it's hard to say that they were doing it. Since he was the chair of the DNC, I mean, and ran for governor, that there had been, you know, that Obama won Virginia twice. Joe Biden won Virginia by 10 points 11 months ago. I think it has more to do with a kind of this sort of anger, whoever is in power right now and not doing enough to deal with inflation, not doing enough to deal with the pandemic that continues on and on, and the supply issues that have gone along with this pandemic. I think there's a lot of anger about that. Uh-huh. And when we add into these social issues, that it becomes a powerful argument.
And Bill Clinton carried Virginia twice, and Hillary carried Virginia. So Terry McAuliffe, in a governor's race, lost Virginia. And once again, people will say he's a terrible candidate. And it seems that no matter whether you lose by a hair, as he did, it was close race, as it was with Eddie Rasponi. When you lose, Mark, they say you're an awful candidate. Hillary lost by a hair, too, and she was an awful candidate. Why is that, where if you win, you're brilliant, and if you lose, you're stupid?
I think that's just the way things are. You know, we ask Ed Ogeron, you know. So.
Well, yeah, it's true about that, is that his malaprops and Cajun mannerisms were endearing when he went 15-0, and then suddenly when he went 9-9, as he has since going 15-0, that's a whole different perception. Henry at the Country Club. Henry, good morning. You're on with Mark.
Oh, good morning, Mr. Mark. Good morning, Mr. Jim. Mr. Jim, after last week's show, you said about how Mr. Mark will take on all comers, all questions, and have some information for us. So I'm going to put him to the test. This morning's paper really came out last night about Mr. David Saunders, a decorated World War II veteran, trying to give to his country and continue to give even in death. And what happens when he donates his body to medical science with all good intentions? They sell tickets for $500 a pop to watch him get an autopsy in Oregon. Is there any way that this can be regulated, perhaps in the next session?
All right. By the way, I'm glad you brought that up. And that is a remarkable story in today's Advocate. It's gruesome and certainly tragic that a 98-year-old World War II veteran who was donating his body to science as a patriot ends up being a showpiece at a convention in Oregon in which they do a public autopsy on him. My God, how does that happen, Mark Ballard?
I am amazed and still astonished and don't know how that could happen. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, I'm sure someone thought they had a great idea that someone else in retrospect probably should have said, no way, no how. The look of this is very bad. As for passing laws, there's very little that Louisiana's legislature can do to pass laws that will have any impact in any other state, including Oregon.
Well, this is a terrible tragedy, but people paid $500 a head to see this, and talk about ghoulish, and it makes you wonder. There's another story that's been in the Advocate in all of its terrible detail about the former sheriff of St. Tammany Parish, Mr. Strain. This guy, if he's found guilty, and there have been numerous witnesses saying he molested them as young boys, including family members, how in the world did this man hold public office and was a law enforcement officer for a generation, Mark?
Well, I think that times were different. This is all before the Me Too movement and what went on in the Catholic Church. They kind of increased our awareness about these kind of crimes or alleged crimes in Sheriff Strain's point. So,
okay, hold tight. We'll return after this message with more Talk Louisiana with Mark Bapp. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Mark Ballard at your service. Let's go to the lines of Richard and French Settlement. Richard, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I don't want to speak out of turn with Henry earlier. It's called a cadaver lab. I know it sounds cruel. It's used widely in the healthcare system, and it has for years. And it's actually very expensive to purchase these bodies, for lack of a better term. And an effort to inform healthcare professionals of the anatomy and physiology of the body. So when we seek to regulate, or if that becomes a hot topic, I hope that it's clear that there's distinguishment between cadaver labs in the healthcare setting and cadaver labs in the private setting.
Okay, Richard. Obviously, this man did not intend to have his body up for public viewing when he was worked on, I think he intended just what you said, for it to be done privately. And
I think that he's correct. I mean, that medical schools and use autopsies as a way of teaching. But this is a difference between an educational moment and an entertainment moment. And that's where we all kind of look like, whoa.
Well, and if the state, people are into ghoulish things. If the state wanted to make some money, imagine a public execution, maybe a firing squad at Tiger Stadium. They would probably fill the arena, charge admission, have tailgating, concessions, parking. It would be a bonanza for the state of Louisiana. Stuart downtown. Stuart, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Jim, Mark, and the audience, as always, good morning. Jim, I'll ask that you allow me to finish my statement in question. Mark, do you think it would be prudent? First of all, thanks for the advocate for, on behalf of thousands of people, for continuing to highlight the horror of the, quote, Blue Klux Klan. And in closing, Mark, do you think it would be prudent that the advocate do, or some major group do some study to find out if our society should demand that anybody that wants to be a policeman must have a minimum of a bachelor's degree, because that will allow these staunch racists to it will force them to sit with other people of other ethnicities. And they.
All right. What about the problems? I think he's referring to state police. The latest from Jim Mustian and Jake Bleiberg's reporting that Jacob Brown, one of these state policemen under investigation, is the son of Bob Brown, then part of state police's top brass, who would rise to second in command despite being reprimanded years earlier for calling black colleagues the N-word and hanging a Confederate flag in his office. What do you think, Mark? Do state police have some real issues that have not been adequately addressed?
I would say not just state police, but all police forces have that. And being related to an awful lot of police officers, I know that this is not the overwhelming majority of people that serve, that it, that there are, you know, loud minorities that within the police ranks that create this situation. And it's obvious that I think that there needs to be more careful scrutiny over who is allowed in.
Patrick in Ennis-Wald Estates. Hi, Patrick. You're on with Mark.
Hey, well, hopefully those police cameras, I think they need to be scrutinized more often, and hopefully they'll put an end to police brutality. But I wanted to get to these amendments that are on the ballot coming up. I guess, why do they put these amendments on the ballot? They're very complicated for the average voter. Most people, I don't think, know what they're voting on. Why don't the representatives make these decisions? Why are these always put on ballots? Maybe not the most informed people are making important decisions for
all
Louisiana.
Right, well, the representatives do get them to the ballot, and it takes two-thirds in both houses, doesn't it, to get a constitutional amendment to the ballot? I think that's right.
It is. It is, and that is true. And the problem is that the language is legal language that's in the Constitution and has to be changed in a legal way. And so that's why these amendments are, you know, so thick and so difficult to understand by just reading what is in the ballot language. I would recommend, though, that there was a fine story that explained all four of the amendments in The Advocate in Times-Picayune. So I would go back and check online for that. But The caller is correct. I mean, the actual wording is very difficult to follow, right, but it has to be so that it can be in the Constitution.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Jim. We voted absentee, and there were the four amendments that we're talking about on that ballot that we got to make decisions on, but I didn't see anything for the cats tax issue or the tax renewal. So anyway, that's my question. Do I have to go do another thing to vote for that?
No, that should have been on your ballot.
Not necessarily. It's only on the city ballots, and it's depending on where you actually live. If you are in the city proper, then it would not. Then it will be on your ballot. But if you're outside the city proper, then it's not.
Yeah, Phil's assigned the location when he calls his show's Jefferson Terrace, so I would think he would be in the city. But sometimes people miss things too. Sometimes they don't see what's on the ballot, and let's hope that's not the case in this instance. Craig in Natchitoches. Craig, good morning. Good morning, Craig.
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen. I got to make a couple of questions about the Virginia and New Jersey governor's race. With the Republican win in Virginia and near miss in New Jersey, from the Republican side, is this the first sign that maybe some candidates are starting to pull away from Trump the way those campaigns were run? And from the Democratic perspective, Are the Democrats learning a lesson that trying to tie their opponents to Trump may no longer be a winning strategy?
Well, we're talking about two states in which Trump lost big. So I don't know that it was bad strategy to tie these people to Trump. And in many cases, they were tied to Trump. But nonetheless, Brett Stevens, Pulitzer Prize winning columnist, New York Times, he says, the Democrats' deeper problem is the persistent and justified perception of a party too often composed of fake moderates and dissembling radicals, middle-of-the-road voters, the kind who still decide elections in purplish places like Virginia since they've been bamboozled. Mark, is the Democratic Party, the national party, reflective of Democrats across the country? And is it any way to grow a party, or is this a case in which Democrats are overplaying their hand?
Well, I think the Democratic Party is like the Republican Party, and that is that there are a number of factions in it that can't agree among themselves. And we saw this when the Republicans were in charge, and we're seeing this again now with the infrastructure bill and the social safety net bill that's before Congress right now. It's not the Republicans that are blocking it. It's the Democrats.
Two Democrats.
Can't agree. Yes. I mean,
yeah, well, if Biden had a 52-48 working majority rather than 50-50, this would have been done. But he doesn't. So he has to deal with Manchin and Sinema, and they're contrarian. And Manchin, it's understandable. He's in West Virginia, a state where Trump got almost 70% of the votes, carried every county. Obviously, he has to be sensitive to that if he wants to stay in office. But Sinema is a different story. She's in a state that's veering blue, and she would lose probably absolutely nothing. But for whatever reason, she is being obstinate about the plan that the president is proposing, and his approval ratings have tanked. John in Lake Charles. John, you're on with Mark. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for having me. I was just wondering y'all's thoughts on vaccine mandates and forcing the workers or firing workers that didn't want a medical procedure. Thanks.
All right. That January 4th is a deadline nationally for big companies, which would include very few in Louisiana, but some. This is a federal mandate. Some people don't like that, Mark.
Yeah, it's a very controversial issue, that is for sure. And on the one hand, they've got to get a handle on this pandemic and kind of put an end to it. And on the other hand, there's the arguments of personal freedom and the decisions that are being made individually about health care. Neither one of those decisions have been fully articulated or decided in the courts or by any of our legislatures.
Tracy at the Capitol, we're short on time, Tracy, but I'll slide this into Mark and we may pick up on it. It was a story that was presented last month in the Advocate from Wilson Tell that the state is considering a 4-day work week. What would this say to people like you and me who work a few more than 4 days a week, Mark?
I think that, what it would say is that that the state it can't handle the workforce coming in on the interstate highways. The idea of that is when we're redoing the I-10, that it will be one great big pileup of automobiles for about 5 years. And so they're trying to come up with ways that would ease that traffic flow. I imagine if the state government does it, then some businesses will pick up on that and do it as well.
Well, Mark, we'll be calling on you again next Thursday. Thanks as always, and it's always a pleasure to receive your insights. Keep going. And thank you for listening today, as always, and we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, for Alondra Villarreal, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned.